Hello, everybody. Today I'm talking to you from a place known as Wiseman's View, one of the most beautiful points in all of Appalachia. Just behind me, you can see a landmark known as Table Rock, and the gorge that exists between this point and that one has one of the most intriguing mysteries in the natural world. This view is a testament to the Earth's majesty, and the age and colors of these hills tell us that whenever God painted the world, his brush must have began in Appalachia. During the day, these hills are home to one of the planet's greatest beauties. But at night, it's home to one of Appalachia's greatest monsters. What you're seeing now is the unexplained Brown Mountain Lights. The Brown Mountain Lights of North Carolina are described as a sort of shooting star or floating spirit. Stories of these ghost lights have haunted the region for years. And to this day, their reputation is one of wonder and terror. The Brown Mountain Lights of the Linville Gorge, that's part of the Pisgah National Forest, is a to-this-day unexplained phenomena. Scientists and locals have spent the past century trying to determine what these lights are. And perhaps just as terrifying as the existence of the lights themselves are the stories that accompany them. So today, we're going to talk about the stories, theories, legends, and monsters that inhabit these hills. And as a spoiler, some of the answers may be more terrifying than I care to admit. Something I want to mention before we begin is that this video would not have been possible without the help of some very kind people. A lot of the stories about the Brown Mountain Lights are regulated to local legend. So, I have been driving around the area of the Linville Gorge for several days looking for people who had family or may know stories relating to the lights. During this time, I met a very kind author by the name of Tense Franklin Banks, who I'll talk about more at the end, who invited me into her home and allowed me to comb through her records that her and her mother had taken for decades that had everything from rare photographs of the lights, to eyewitness accounts, to local folklore. She wrote a book regarding the area that will be linked in the description, and this video would not have been possible without her. Also, several of the photographs I'm going to use from this video will come from the Ark Adventures on YouTube, who has the best photos ever of the Brown Mountain Lights, and a man named Burgess Bell, whose favorite pastime is going up to Wiseman's View and taking pictures of the lights. While I was there getting footage for my video, I met him and he was very kind, taught me how to use my camera, and even offered me access to several of his pictures and videos, and I greatly appreciate it, and he'll be linked in the description as well. Several of the stories you're about to hear have never existed in the public record until now. So hopefully, you're at least half as excited to hear it as I am to tell it. So today, for the Halloween season, we are going to talk about one of nature's most haunting mysteries, the Brown Mountain Lights. And hopefully I don't fall off a cliff, although that would get a lot of views. And as an important announcement before we get started, ladies and gentlemen, I present you him. He is finally here. This empty vessel, Wendigoon U2's doll, is available to purchase at the link in the description. U2's allowed me to design this pagan idol, vinyl figure. I gotta stop doing that. And I couldn't be happier with how it turned out. Look how well they did on, the hair and the antlers. Isn't he just the cutest? They even let me design the box, which has an entrance to Hollow Earth and a spooky forest wrapped around it, along with several of my stupid quotes that I'm honestly surprised they let me get away with. And every time one of these little guys is sold, it supports me directly. So if you decide to pick one up, that really means the world, and I greatly appreciate it. And know that it will go directly towards funding more of these self-destructive ventures that I call YouTube videos. So again, live now at the link in the description at u2s.com. He'll be here for a very short time, and then he's gone forever. I should also mention that I am not responsible for any chanting or whispering that you hear while in his presence. But don't let that scare you off. Feel free to put him anywhere in the house, and there's never a reason to hide from him. He already knows your sins. Again, thank you all so much for supporting me. It really does mean the most. Hope you check him out. Link is in the description, and we are back to the video. We are going to go ahead and get into it, but as always, thank you for watching. Now, there's a lot to cover with the Brown Mountain Lights, so it's probably best that I start at the beginning. The first official mention of the lights specifically comes from a 1912 article in the Charlotte Observer. In that article, it says that the locals have begun to see strange lights appear within the Linville Gorge, which is, as mentioned, the gorge here. Now, this wasn't the first written mention of the lights, we'll get to that later, however, it was the first published mention. With this announcement, the lights became a local legend, and people from all over the country began to come to the Linville Gorge and here at Wiseman's View to view the lights for themselves. And if you've seen the lights directly, there's really no mistaking them. These giant floating orbs of what appears to be fire or lightning that hover in and above the tree line. It became a national spectacle, and so much of a spectacle, in fact, that the government got involved. In 1913, the United States Geological Survey, or the USGS, sent an agent named D.B. Sterrett to come investigate these claims of the Brown Mountain Lights. D.B. Sterrett walked to the top of Wiseman's View, took a quick look over the hillside, and determined that people were just looking at train lights. Legit, he gave the official report that these bunch of dumb yokels just saw a train and thought it was God or something. Which, a few notes on that. For one, people know what trains look like. Two, even though Sterrett argued that it could have been reflections from the train light around the hills, reflections don't look like that. And three, that's not a train light. So, as you can imagine, the locals were not convinced. Especially when a large flood hit the area in 1916, and despite all of the railways and electricity being shut down for several weeks, the light still appeared. Also during this time, a local hotel owner and his son, George and Joseph Lovin, began to gather accounts from visitors who would stay in the hotel who were coming up to Wiseman's View to see the lights. From several of these accounts of these burning balls of fire rising up above the tree line and then wisping across the canyon at impossible speeds, the lights graduated from a local oddity to a national legend. So, in 1922, the USGS sent in another agent, this time a man by the name of George Mansfield, to stay in the region for 2 weeks, gather hard evidence, and dispel the rumors of these ghost lights for good. So Mansfield stayed at the Lovin's Hotel for 2 weeks, and while he was there, used all manner of charts, maps, telescopes, in order to determine what these lights are. Now here's the problem with that. Anyone who's been in the region, locals especially, can tell you that the Brown Mountain Lights are not a for sure occurrence. Especially nowadays, when several of the areas around the mountains have hiking trails and ATV paths through them, it's hard to determine if a light you're seeing is a headlight or maybe the start of what will become a Brown Mountain Light. Tince Banks, the author I mentioned earlier, who wrote a book on the region and has lived here her entire life, has said she has only definitely seen the lights 5 times. And again, when you definitely see them, you definitely see them, but it's not an everyday occurrence. So just because this guy from the USGS came down here to go fishing for 2 weeks, doesn't mean he was going to catch anything. As a matter of fact, the Lovins family said they came up here with Mansfield whenever he did his surveys, and every night he was there, the lights didn't happen. So, after 2 weeks, Mansfield published a 30-page paper detailing his analysis of these Brown Mountain lights. In his report, Mansfield would conclude, about 47% of the lights that the writer was able to study instrumentally were due to automobile headlights, 33% to locomotive headlights, 10% to stationary lights, and 10% to brush fires. Which, once again, not a train. The leading theory of the time was that whenever the surrounding counties became electrified and towns like Spruce Pine and Morganton had a power grid for the first time, it caused a series of reflections and refractions across the mountainside that caused the illusion of the Brown Mountain Lights. And to be fair to the USGS, official publications did coincide with the same time that electricity began to enter the area. The whole surrounding county was pretty much electrified by 1911, 1912, and the first official publication, as I mentioned, was 1913. Another thing that's also fair to mention to them is that in 1911, Jules Verne, the author who wrote Journey to the Center of the Earth, The Mysterious Island, and several other works, published a novel called Master of the World. And in the book Master of the World, a scientist who's in Table Rock, which is... right there. And while inside of Table Rock, the scientist in the story created all these crazy contraptions like flying machines that caused these energy balls to float out of the rock and around the mountain itself. So it's really convenient that 2 years before people start talking about the Brown Mountain Lights, a famous author put out a book where giant floating lights float around the mountain. So the government looked down here at Appalachia and said, oh, all these people, they're getting tore up with, you know, their electricity and trains and reading, and it was just too much for them, and their brain conjured up the lights. And that would be fine and dandy if the first accounts were in 1913. But the Brown Mountain Lights go back further, much further. The earliest supposed account of the Brown Mountain Lights goes back to 1771, when a man by the name of Jean-William Gerard de Brom was hired by King George to come to the colonies, which is what North Carolina was at the time, and survey the land before reporting back to the king. In his statement, de Brom said this, and it's very pompous, but bear with me. In a heavy atmosphere, the nitrous vapors are swallowed up through the spiracles of the mountains, and thus the country is cleared from their corrosion. When the atmosphere is light, these nitrous vapors rise up to the arsenical and sulfurous, subliming through the spiracles of the mountains, and when they meet with each other in contact, the nitre inflames, vulgarates, and detonates, whence the frequent thunders in which a most volatilized spirit of nitre ascends to purify, inspire the upper air, and phlogiston regeneratum descends to impregnate the bowels of the earth. So, you know, weird light stuff happens. However, this account I don't necessarily stand by. For one, de Brom was never officially supposed to survey North Carolina. He was supposed to survey South Carolina down into Florida. And while he would have passed through the region, it's not likely that's what he was writing about. And although it's hard to tell because he speaks the way he does, he's probably talking about thunderstorms. So I wouldn't put a lot of faith on that one, but what I would put faith on is the account of a man named Fate Wiseman. Around 1854, a young boy by the name of Fate Wiseman climbed to the top of the Linville Mountain to go camping for the night. That night, while on top of the mountain, he said he looked down into the valley and saw these giant burning orbs that floated above the tree line, so numerous it was hard for him to count, and he watched as they traced their way up to Table Rock and back down to the river. Several of his friends, who he invited to come up here and camp with him over the following years, all had the same story of these bright orbs appearing. It's for that reason that the mountaintop I'm sitting on right now is known as Wiseman's View. Decades later, Fate's great nephew, a man by the name of Scotty Wiseman, would become a famous country music singer. And in 1961, he wrote a song about the stories his great uncle would tell him. We'll talk about the stories in a minute, but we're sticking to the timeline for now. What's also funny about Wiseman's account is whenever skeptics try to talk it down, because remember, the leading theory, at least decades back, was that the electricity around the mountain is what was causing the lights, and 1854 is well before any electricity in the area. Whenever all these official accounts look at it, they're like, well, there was a railroad built there 4 years later. Like, can we stop talking about the trains? So not only was it a locally known fact that the lights were here among families like the Wisemans and the Lovins, but a book written in the 1930s called The Guide to the Old North State lists several sightings of the lights dating back to the Civil War. And furthermore, a local article that was written in 1922 to dispel Mansfield's story of what the lights could be lists several sightings that occurred during a trip in 1908, before Jules Verne's novel, before the electrification, or the stories of the lights becoming popular. And also, I don't think I have to tell you this, but that's not how electricity works. If that was how it works, every field or forest in the country would be full of these giant lightning bolts every night, but they're not for some reason. So if that theory can be debunked, then what are some of the other theories people have come up with for what the lights could be? Well, one of the most popular theories up until recent years was that of the Will-O-Wisps, also known as gas lights. Gas lights are a natural phenomenon that occurs whenever gas and chemicals inside of a swampy area rise up into the air before igniting. They're quite rare, but again, common in swampy environments. However, thorough studies of the gorge, the minerals, the river, and the ground around it show that there was not only no swampy environment, but no presence of chemicals that could create a swamp light. Another theory that was suggested was that of St. Elmo's fire, a really wild occurrence that can happen in thunderstorms, especially out over the ocean, where lightning will form on the ground and create these massive balls of hate. St. Elmo's fire can also be seen on airplanes, as it looks like tiny little strikes of lightning jumping across the windshield. However, St. Elmo's fire is only known to occur in thunderstorms and is once again very rare. There's a theory that the lights are a mirage or a sort of optical illusion whenever the light bounces off maybe the water in the rivers or the rock faces around. However, mirages are most often superimposed over one's eye. And it's very clear in videos and photographs of the Brown Mountain lights that they illuminate the area around them. So definitely not some kind of optical illusion. Because if it was, you wouldn't be able to see things in the dark that you couldn't just see with your eye. Another theory is that of foxfire. Foxfire is a slightly bioluminescent fungus that does grow around the region. However, keyword being slightly. And since you can see the lights from mountaintops across, that's a no. Another theory is that perhaps there's hidden uranium or some kind of radiation deposit in the mountains that cause random lights for some reason. But radiation rarely ever does that, and normally if it does, it's a much bigger problem than just a floating light. And also, there's no evidence of there being radioactive materials anywhere in these hills. The three theories that seem to have some merit is, for one, the concept of ball lightning. Ball lightning is, again, a very rare phenomena. Whenever static that's either in the ground or comes off of some kind of electric system creates these floating static things that just kind of float around. However, ball lightning is incredibly rare in places that have prime conditions for them, and unless there's some kind of static producing something underneath this mountain, that's a no-go. The other is that perhaps there's some kind of chemical reaction that we're not aware of, kind of like the gas lights that I mentioned earlier. However, perhaps this chemical is something that hasn't been traced yet, or there hasn't been evidence found yet of it existing in these hills, and it's just some combination that hasn't really been thought of yet in science or physics that just kind of jumps together whenever it feels like it. And the third option is maybe these hills are just weird. Maybe there is some perfect combination here of this rock facing that rock, facing that water, facing that rock, that causes moonlight to get magnified, or maybe the hills are just quirky for some reason. Investigations into the explanations for the lights have been going on for decades, nearly a century at this point. In 1940, a man by the name of Hobart Whitman did extensive studies on the soils, geology, and biology of this entire gorge and determined there was nothing out of the ordinary. In 1981, a group known as Orion placed a giant 500,000 candle power light over in Lenore, which is about 22 miles in that direction. And whenever they turned the light on, people who were standing here on Wiseman's View said they did see a reflection of light over the hillside, which, duh. And again, reflections of light are not what this looks like. Also, just to give you an idea of how frustrated everyone is with the lights at this point, that same group, Orion, there was a theory going around that perhaps the ball lightning or something is caused by seismic activity. Like there's underground plate shifting that causes an energy strike, kind of like a match, and that makes the lights float up. So to test that, in 1981, they just started chucking TNT all over the mountainside. Just started blowing up the hills. But sadly, nothing happened. Although I appreciate their effort. In 1998, an Appalachian State professor named Daniel Caden began a project where he got a bunch of different cameras and placed them all around the gorge that periodically took pictures over several hours. And despite gathering over 6,300 hours of footage, there were no lights seen that could not be accounted for. However, considering several of these studies were done under limited times and with older equipment, the validity of how well the cameras could pick up a bright thing that was really far away is dubious at best. And again, since the lights aren't a surefire thing, a lot of people didn't buy into their studies. So what gives? Why is it so hard to figure out what these lights are, and do they even exist? Well, for the footage I gathered for this video, I used a handy little tool called night vision. Night vision, for those that don't know, works by using ambient light that's in the air and magnifying it. So things that are low light become normal light, and things that have any amount of light to them become these giant solar flares. Because of that, if there's any light signature within these hills, if you look at it through night vision, it becomes a beacon. Now, while I think a lot of the footage you're seeing is beautiful, I can't attest to its validity. As mentioned, a lot of people go camping in these hills, and it's hard to determine if anything you're seeing now is just a flashlight or a campfire, rather than these supernatural lights. And again, I've only been up here to record for a few days, and the likelihood of me getting a perfect video of a light while I have my night vision is not the best.
I did see this deer, though, so that's still pretty cool.
For what it's worth, however, I can personally attest that I have seen the Brown Mountain lights. A couple years back, I came out here with my friend who originally told me about these lights, and of course, me being me, I had to come up here. And while looking down into the gorge, I saw what can only be described as a giant flare begin beneath the tree line before floating above it and then turning a sort of yellowish red before it floated its way up towards Table Rock and then circled back down near the river and went out. The only thing I can possibly give this an explanation to is someone lit a really long multicolored flare and tied it to a drone, just to be mean. But I can attest that whenever you see them, there's certainly nothing like them. It looks like a giant spotlight or a UFO hovering just above the trees before snaking its way over the gorge and then making its way down to the river. It was so wild that as soon as I saw it, I was like, wow, that was a crazy hallucination. But I sympathize with people who just want to simply know more. For those that have seen them, it's something incredible and something that you have to figure out. But there's also a beauty in the ignorance. It seems like nowadays, with science being what it is, every factor of our lives or of the magnificent world goes from these fantastic beasts to documented creatures. And the world loses a little bit of magic when that happens. So I've always loved the Brown Mountain lights because, in spite of everyone's attempts, it still has its magic. And it's because of that magic that I want to talk about my favorite details of the lights, the story surrounding them. The first night I got here, I decided to drive up to Wiseman's View by myself, which I can say, as someone who's native to Appalachia, is still a pretty freaky experience. The road, for one, is not friendly. If you ever plan to make your way up to Wiseman's View, the GPS will not help you, and you better hope that your car can. When I came up, there was absolutely no one on the mountain, and the fear of being completely by yourself in a national park is incredible. I love it. But as you make your way up the mountain, there's this kind of air that begins to reach into you, because these hills are filled with so many legends, and the lights themselves are such a sacred kept monster to the people around here that going to confront them by yourself is uplifting as it is demeaning. You climb this castle to fight a dragon that may not even be there. And that aura, that idea of monsters that you can't see, is something that permeates Appalachia. See, we are a very superstitious people, at least in our stories. And this group of people who spent decades dealing with poverty, famine, flood, and war. As you could imagine, several of these superstitions are pretty dark. I remember as a young boy, my grandfather would set me down, and he would tell me all kinds of scary stories. Stories from his family, the Cherokee, and their legends that ran through these hills. And stories of ghosts, monsters, boogeymen that would keep you up at night. However, the stories he told me never really scared me. I understood that objectively they were scary, and that the things that happened in them were decisively not good, but they never bothered me, because whenever he would tell me these things, he would just be excited. He would be so happy to share them. And anytime I'd asked him about that, I'd be like, how can you talk about this? It's such a scary, dark story. Why are you so okay with it? And he would always say, well, I've already heard it, and now I get to tell it to you. And I didn't get what he meant for a long time, but a lot of these stories were stories that his grandfather would tell him, and his grandfather before him, and generations back. And like I said earlier, a lot of these stories are never written down. They never exist outside of one person telling it to another. But there's a secrecy to that's hard to wrap your head around. These legends, these characters, they exist in my brain. They exist in my soul, so to speak. And whenever you give them to someone else, you're not writing it on paper so that any passerby could see. You are putting it in them. It is their soul now. It is a part of who they are. And there's something beautiful about, no matter how harrowing or disturbing the subject matter might be, that it is a piece of you that you are giving to someone else that will live on forever. I mean, it was my grandfather who originally told me stories of the Wendigo, and you can see how I took that to heart. Over the past few days, whenever I've just been harassing random people into telling me their stories about the lights, none of them were secretive about it. No one was like, oh, well, this is a family secret, you shouldn't pass it on. As soon as I told them what I'm doing, they all said, thank you for telling these stories. And that's not anything to point at me and say how great I am, but the privilege to pass these on, to tell these stories, and to have those pieces now, and to get to share them with you, to be the orator who holds a part of a legacy that outlived the person who made it, and will outlive any of us to come, and to get to use those pieces to build something as immortal as these mountains. It's an honor. So I guess you could say, I've already heard these stories, and now I get to tell you. Now, many of these stories were born of a spirit of fear and terror, and it's only necessary that I do right by the story and the season and treat them as such. And while many have their theories and ideas to what the lights could mean, these are the ones that I find the most interesting. If you'll remember, as I said earlier, the first person to see the Brown Mountain Lights was Fate Wiseman in 1854. However, what I didn't tell you at the time is Fate didn't find this as odd as he did terrifying, because the Linville Gorge was known to be haunted with the spirits of old Henry and Jim. Before the Civil War in the 1840s, North Carolina, while it would one day side with the Union, did hold many slave owners. Among them was a man by the name of Henry. One year, in the 1840s, Henry bought himself a slave by the name of Jim. Jim was a very kind-hearted man, and all who spoke to him said that, despite his condition, he exuded confidence and kindness to whoever he met. Perhaps it was this kindness that changed the heart of Henry, as not long after purchasing Jim, he gave Jim his freedom. But Jim, having nowhere to live and no family to call his own, decided to stick around with Henry, and the two lived together for several years. That was until one particularly brutal winter, when a low harvest from the season prior left Henry's family with nothing to eat. Henry, seeing no other option, decided to set out one December night and hunt himself a bear. Now, bears are a dangerous predator, and Henry knew this, but if a man could get himself a bear, he could feed his wife and kid for months on end. So Henry grabbed his jacket, cap, and rifle, and said goodbye to his family and goodbye to Jim, told them that he would be back in 4 days' time. Well, 4 days passed, and Henry never came home. The family and Jim knew what this probably meant, but Jim, loving the man who gave him his freedom, decided that he wasn't at least going to try to save his friend. On the fifth night, Jim grabbed a lantern and decided to head out to find Henry. Now, he knew that Henry had taken a lantern and enough oil to last a week, so he figured if he got out there tonight and stood on top of the mountain, perhaps he could see Henry walking somewhere in the tree line. So Jim grabbed a lantern, said goodbye to Henry's family, and set out to find him. Until, after 4 days, it seems that Jim was just as long gone as Henry had been. Eventually, Henry's family had to move away from the area, and over the next couple years, everyone seemed to forget about old Henry and old Jim. That was till in 1854, when Fate Wiseman saw their lanterns walking through the tree line from on top of Wiseman's View. Now, it had been too long for the possibility of these two being alive, and, if anything, this was their restless soul trudging across the gorge. And as a matter of fact, according to Fate and those who witnessed it, if you waited on a night for the lights to appear and listened close enough as they worked their way up the hill, you could hear Henry and Jim calling out to each other, both of them forced to forever walk the hills that had long since forgotten them. Now, believe it or not, Henry and Jim isn't the oldest legend of the Brown Mountain Lights. That honor would go to the story of the unnamed Revolutionary War soldier who came home to find his family lost to the gorge. As legend has it, before the Revolutionary War, a colonial family decided to settle in the gorge. However, when the war came, the father, whose name's been lost to history, but we'll call the Patriot, decided that he needed to fight. The Patriot kissed his wife and three kids goodbye and decided to set out to fight for his country. After a year of fighting, he returned home to find that his family had been lost forever. The cabin that he had built for them had burned up, perhaps in some act of malice, perhaps a simple accident. Either way, the Patriot runs to the charred remains of his home to find pieces of his family dismembered and dragged across the floor from months of weather and animals. The Patriot began to scream and wail as he grabbed the pieces of his family and dragged them across the floorboard to make sense of what had befallen them. He finds a leg bone and tries to connect it to a hip. He finds a skull and tries to connect it to a neck. By the end of his screaming, he looks down at this horrific puzzle that he's pieced together to see that he has six arms and six legs and three heads, assembled on his wife and two of his children. But the third seemed to be missing. Now, the Patriot could have been wrong. Perhaps two of the arms he had misplaced as one of his children, and instead it was one from the known child and the unknown missing child, and the other two from each had been dragged away by the weather or hounds. But that didn't matter to him. He had six arms, six legs, and three heads. That meant one of his kids might still be alive. With this revelation, the Patriot begins to make a noise, something between horror and joy, as he runs into the gorge, screaming like a hound, looking for his lost child. The Patriot was never seen again, but it's said that one of the Brown Mountain Lights zigzags its way along the river, up the trees, to Table Rock, and back down the valley, screaming all the while for his lost child. So if you're ever in the Linville Gorge or at Wiseman's View with your family, it's best to make sure your kid's always in sight. But perhaps the most famous story of the Brown Mountain Lights is that of Lady Adeline. Lady Adeline and her husband moved to Western North Carolina around 1840. Now, it was said that Lady Adeline was a joy to be around, and everyone in the town took to her instantly. But her husband was a no-good drunk. He was known for long nights of drinking and a short temper to match, and everyone in the town had a sneaking feeling that one day something bad would happen to Adeline. And sadly, in 1848, it seems those fears came true. One Sunday morning, Adeline didn't come to church, so her friends decided to go look for her at her home. When they got there, all they found was her drunk husband, who said that Adeline had decided to up and leave him in the middle of the night. Now, this doesn't sound like something Adeline would do. Sure, it may have been best for her, but she was determined to help her husband no matter what it would take. The next day, the townspeople saw a visitor who they noticed strolled to a local motel only a few days prior, leave the town, riding Adeline's husband's horse. Now, this was suspicious, so the same people who went looking for Adeline went back to her house to talk to her husband. But he said that the man had simply purchased the horse off of him, and that it was none of their business. But people continued to think that perhaps this man wanted rid of his Christian wife, and this stranger helped him do it. So, people began to search for Adeline, and whenever they decided to search for her in the nearby Linville Gorge, the Brown Mountain Lights appeared. The men who were searching for Adeline were terrified. The lights gave off an overwhelming sense of dread that made it hard to even breathe. The men ran out of the gorge screaming and straight to Adeline's husband's home. The hate and fear that exuded from these lights convinced the men that Adeline's husband had conjured up the devil. So they go to his house with pistols and knives and kick down the door, ready to make him answer for what he's done. But whenever they check the house, it seems he's nowhere to be found. And off in the distance, they saw one of the Brown Mountain Lights snaking its way over the hill and back down into the gorge. Over the next several decades, men would disappear from the Linville Gorge area, seemingly at random. Authorities and locals alike would search the gorge for some kind of answer. Until one day, as they were searching at the base of the cliff that is today known as Wiseman's View, they found the headless body of Lady Adeline. Now, she was identified by the dress and locket that she was wearing, but as mentioned, her head was nowhere to be found. It seems that either out of pure hatred or just a drunken rage, Adeline's husband had taken off her head and thrown her over Wiseman's View. But despite not having any eyes, if that light leaving his home the night the men came to find him wasn't a coincidence, and it seems Adeline was able to find him just fine. Legend has it that if you're a man It's best to never visit the Linville Gorge by yourself, especially at night. Because while it seems Adeline may only be hunting the heads of the men who do women wrong, she may not have the best eyesight. And if you're anyone in the Linville Gorge at night, and you see a headless woman walking through the trees, looking for her missing head or hateful men, it's best to just let her pass. Whether you believe in ghost stories or not, it's hard to deny that weird things happen around the Linville Gorge. In the 1980s, a man named James Gennett reported having seen the lights after returning to his hotel on his last night in town. The next day, his car was found in the opposite direction he was said to be traveling, but James wasn't in it. In fact, James was nowhere to be found, and he was never seen again. But for some reason, his car sat abandoned in the Linville Gorge. And of course, there's the wildlife of the gorge as well. Not only things like bears and snakes, but stories of people called the river rats, who run through the trees, and if you're lucky, simply scare you away. Now, many people doubt stories of the river rats and think them to be the stuff of urban legends. But the odd piece of clothing or half-eaten food found in the most obscure parts of the gorge's wilderness beg to differ. So regardless if you believe in the spirit of the Brown Mountain Lights or not, the gorge definitely has something that goes bump in the night. Locals know to stay away from it, even if they don't know the ghost stories or legends surrounding the gorge itself. Hunters say that you can never hunt anything up there, because anytime you bring your dogs, the dog will run out, get afraid, and come back, refusing to leave their owner's side. Lumbermen who try to cut trees around the gorge say that it's useless, the ground's sour for some reason, and nothing seems to grow right. Now, if you believe in any of the stories I've told, what's to say that they all can't work together? There's been countless battles across the area of the Linville Gorge, from the Native Americans to the Revolutionary War to the Civil War. Seemingly hundreds, if not thousands, of lives have been lost among those hills. Who's to say that Adeline can't walk by the river while the Patriot runs through the hills and Jim and Henry keep circling each other among the trees? Some of the most popular stories of the Brown Mountain Lights involve the battles I mentioned earlier, from the Civil War all the way back to the Native Wars. It's believed that after these battles were over, the women, whose husbands and sons died in the war, would go out at night with torches and lanterns, looking for the bodies of the men they loved, and that those who found them, slain on the battlefield, were forever cursed to continue to haunt those hills to this day. What's interesting about all the stories that I've said is that they all derive from real-world tragedies. There were people murdered and thrown into the gorge. There were people who died of starvation in the hills. And there were people whose families were lost while they were helpless to stop it. And what all of these stories do is they take these tragedies, these real-world experiences people had, and they make them the stuff of legends. They make it to where their suffering meant something greater, something that still affects us to this day, other than a pointless tragedy. One of the reasons that I love horror and scary stories like this is because it elevates human suffering to something that means something. And whenever I think of these stories, I think about the beauty that lies in all the evil. However, while I do love the scary stories of the gorge, there's a special place in my heart for the stories that show love rather than fear. One of those stories is that of the Catawba woman and the Cherokee man. Hundreds and hundreds of years ago, before white settlers ever came to the land, the Cherokee people and the Catawba people were at war with each other. Now, during this war, the Linville Gorge was a highly contested spot that both sides fought over constantly. Despite this, however, a Catawba woman fell in love with a Cherokee man. And at night, they would slip down into the Linville Gorge, the middle ground between their two people, and through the night they would share their intimacy and time together before going back to their tribes the next morning. Now, if either side ever figured out what they were doing, they would want the other one dead. So they had to keep it secret, and night after night, they would meet each other at the river in the gorge. That is until one day, when the Cherokee man told the woman that he would have to go fight in the war. Now, of course, they were devastated by this, but she decided she would make the most of it and make sure he knows that her love carries on. So, she went to the top of what is now Wiseman's View and built herself a small house. And every night, she would go to the window of that house and light a torch. Now, The Cherokee man would be on the other side of the gorge, and she couldn't know if he was able to see it. But every now and then, he would pass through the trees and see that torch on top of Linville Mountain and know that his love lives on. Some nights, he would even sneak up to the hills to get away from the other soldiers and light his own torch, so that even if a little bit, her love could be reciprocated. And she would know that her love was still out there, and he was still alive. Till one night, the torch didn't light back. And as a matter of fact, it never came back. It seems that perhaps he died in some war or of some illness, but the worst part is she could never know, because she was still separated by the war of their people and the river at the bottom of the gorge. However, she had promised him that she would light that torch. So every night, she lit it continuously. She eventually became an old woman, but she never forgot the love she had for that Cherokee man. And as legend has it, even though she's long gone, if you look for the Brown Mountain lights at night, you can see that that love still lives on. See, several young couples will say that the Linville Gorge is a wildly romantic spot. And if you've seen the scenery, you know it's at least a breathtaking one. Perhaps the reason that it still holds such a great love, despite all the evil that surrounds it, is because of the light of that Catawba woman. Another story, and I think the best one to end on, comes from the 1930s. In the nearby area of Jonas Ridge, there was a man who, for all intents and purposes, was similar to the husband of Adeline. He was a hateful drunk who was no good for anyone, especially his young wife, Belinda. After Belinda gave birth to their child, he got drunk one night and simply decided that it wasn't his. And in a fit of rage, depending on who you asked, he either killed them and dumped their body into the gorge, or chased them into the gorge, and nature did what nature does. Over the next several days, search crews began to look for Belinda and her child. However, it seems they couldn't find a trace of either of them. That was until night began to fall, and for the first time, to at least some, the Brown Mountain lights appeared. Now, while all the other stories I mentioned tell the lights as being this possibly demonic, hateful force of evil, this time, they seemed to be a source of compassion. They appeared above the search workers' heads and worked their way through the tree line. The search workers decided to follow them, and sure enough, found freshly dead bodies of Belinda and her child. Now, while this story is, of course, in parts a tragedy because their lives were lost, it seems the lights didn't want them to suffer the same fate that the lights themselves might have. In fact, there are several stories of young children being separated from their parents while in the gorge, when just as the sun sets, the lights appear and guide them back home. Whenever I was driving around the county half-crazed, looking for people to tell me about the ghost lights, which is pretty on-brand, I guess, I met this guy who asked what I was doing, because, you know, it's kind of weird to go into a business and ask for someone by their full name. And I told him that I was going to do a video about the Brown Mountain Lights. And this man immediately perked up and said, "Oh, the Brown Mountain Lights, one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen." Something like that will make a man think of God. And it sure will. Regardless of if you believe these stories, between all the tales of war and death, I think it's safe to say that Appalachia has enough monsters and are definitely all too real. So when it comes to the Brown Mountain Lights, I like to think that maybe it's got a few angels. Regardless of if you believe the Brown Mountain Lights to be some lost soul or simply a trick of the light, it's hard to deny that they are certainly a spectacle. And I think we can all agree that these hills full of their stories and legends aren't going to give up their secrets anytime soon. But hey, who would want to ruin the magic? And if you stuck around this long, hopefully you think the Brown Mountain Lights are at least a little bit as interesting as I know they are, and that's really cool, because I do too. And after all of that, I just want to say thank you for watching. Also, I forgot to mention it in the outro, but remember to check out this guy. He's really cool and only bites on occasion, I swear. This was a very big project for me. All of my research, or at least like 99% of it up until now, is just sitting in my room reading info online. But getting to spend several days driving around this small town asking for local legends and stories regarding the lights was insane. I loved it. I had such a great time doing this. Obviously, it was more involved and not something that I could reliably do on a quick basis. But for a project every now and then, absolutely, I loved it. And hopefully you guys enjoyed it at least a little bit. And hopefully this is something you may want to see more of in the future. If you don't, that's also fine. You don't have to like the videos that I like making. But I had a lot of fun doing this. It was fulfilling, in a way, to take these stories and then to put them out there for everyone. And I always loved being the storyteller, so it meant a lot. So something I want to do for this video, that is not something I've done for any other videos, but since the Brown Mountain Lights are a... almost, well, not non-existent, but the stories and, like, ideas around them are not known to the public as much as other cryptids, like Mothman or Bigfoot. And I know it's weird to call them a cryptid, but it's the closest thing I could think of. Since there's not a ton of information about them, and since I may be... would I be the YouTuber who... I'm definitely the only one who made a video like this on them, at least to my knowledge. Anyway, since I know a decent amount about the lights, and it may be hard if someone's interested to find out more information. If you have a question about the lights, leave it in the comments, and I will pick out a few, and then on my second channel, Windigang, that I almost never use, again, it'll be linked in the description, on my second channel, I will make a video responding to your questions about the lights, and we'll try to answer them to the best of my ability, because I feel decent enough in my knowledge about them that I could probably answer most questions. So if you have any questions about them or just want to know more, again, leave it in the comments and I'll pick out a few for that video over on Windigang, again, the second channel. And also, once again, Tense Franklin Banks, she wrote this book about the Linville Falls, which is an area right next to the Linville Gorge. This has its own lore and murders and crazy ghost stories and all that. And she also wrote a book about the Wiseman family, which, if you'll remember, is... Fate Wiseman, the one who originally saw them in 1854 and all of that. So she's very knowledgeable about the area, and she writes a lot of interesting stories about the region's folklore and what have you. And she's also an incredibly kind woman. The way I got into contact with her is I drove around the county looking for members of the Lovin family and the Wiseman family, and I eventually go to the museum in the county, and... the lady at the museum, who was very kind, she thought it was cool that I was doing a video about the lights, put me in contact with Tense. And Tense was like, oh, well, just tell him to come to my house. So I go to her house, and she's an older lady now, and she spent her entire life gathering information about the region, and her mother did the same thing, collecting photographs and documents. So she has an entire room of her house that's just like these folders of information. And she hands me two giant folders about the Brown Mountain Lights. And just it has all the stories that you can't find anywhere online. And all these photographs that don't exist anywhere online. And it was just like a wealth of information. And the entire time I was talking to her, I kept being like, can I pay you somehow? Can I do anything to... you know, make up for this? It means the world. And she said, it means enough that you're telling the stories. And I really, as someone who like really appreciates the value of a good story, that meant a lot to me. She's very cool. And again, wherever I can find her stuff for sale, I'll link in the description. If they're not linked there when the video goes up, check back again. I will find them. I'm determined to. But no, she's incredibly kind. And to just allow me to do that. She even offered to like give me a lot of the stuff. She was like, do you want to take or at least borrow some of the folders? I'm like, no, I cannot take these away from you. So I just took pictures of them and all that, but she was a blessing. Also, Bell Burgess, who I mentioned earlier, he's a very cool guy. He has a YouTube channel and an Instagram. He does a lot of mountain biking stuff. Again, he'll be linked in the description. But whenever I got up there to film the lights, he was already set up with a camera to do the same thing. And I started asking him, like, how often do you do this? And he's like, oh, at least once a week. I was out here on Christmas in the snow at 4 a.m. trying to get pictures of the lights. Like, they really do have a culture all to themselves. And it was great that all these people allowed me to take part in that. And it meant the world. So, yeah, I'm a little excited, if you couldn't tell. But, yeah, happy Halloween. I hope that this was a satisfactory Halloween video for you all. I was thinking what I want to do for Halloween like a couple months ago, and I thought like campfire stories would be good, and this seemed like the perfect route to do it. So hopefully you enjoyed. I definitely enjoyed it. And yeah, if you ever want to see investigations like this in the future, let me know, because I really enjoy making them. I can't do them all the time again, but every now and then they're a lot of fun. But I believe that should do it. That covers about everything. So, I guess before we leave, I just want to say, Happy Halloween. Thank you for watching. I hope that you enjoyed, and I will see you in the next one. Bye!